I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. After a power outage took out my internet over the weekend, I am back, and hopefully this show will make up for my absence. There may be a few more shows than usual published this week to make up for the lack of shows last week. In any case, on this edition of the program, we'll be speaking with Michael Link, a Canadian legal scholar and the current United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian occupied territories since 1967. In this conversation, we're going to be discussing the Israel-Palestine issue from an international law and human rights perspective. I hope you find the conversation to be thoughtful and informative. And with that being said, let's get right to it with Michael Link, Canadian legal scholar and the current United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Palestinian occupied territories since 1967. Welcome to Parallax Views, Michael Link, Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory, occupied since 1967. I should say UN Special Rapporteur. How are you doing today, Michael?
Fine, thanks. Thank you very much for having me.
So, for my listeners, if you could, can you give a little bit of background in regards to your expertise in legal matters and international law, as well as what it means to be a UN Special Rapporteur?
Sure. Personally, I'm a law professor in London, Ontario, Canada, at the University of Western Ontario, where I've taught since 1999. My main work is in labor law, but my I had worked for the United Nations in Jerusalem and the West Bank in 1989, doing human rights and refugee work. And I had already had an interest in the area. I wrote a lot on international law and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the period after I came back. I returned to the area on a number of occasions. And I generally kept up with what was being written and what was being said about it. So that was probably the impetus for me wanting to apply in 2016 when the post of the Special Rapporteur had come open. And I was subsequently appointed by the Human Rights Council in March of 2016 to serve a six-year unpaid volunteer position as Special Rapporteur. I keep my day job as a law professor. But I devote a third of my time to issues involving human rights in the occupied Palestinian territory. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, the Human Rights Council or its predecessor had created what they call the UN Special Procedures, which is the creation of special rapporteur positions, both on a thematic basis and on a geographic specific basis. To be able to alert the world to human rights trends and human rights abuses. Today, there are about 55 or so human rights special rapporteurs appointed by the Human Rights Council. The bulk of them, probably around 40, 4:45, our thematic mandates, the special rapporteur on the right to food, on the right to housing, special rapporteur on extreme poverty, and so on. And there are about 10 to 12 of us who are special rapporteur for a specific region. The special rapporteur for human rights in North Korea, in Myanmar, in Cambodia, and myself, a special rapporteur on human rights in the occupied Palestinian territory. So what I do is, like all my special rapporteur colleagues, we are required to report, to deliver reports twice a year, one to the UN General Assembly in New York and one to the Human Rights Council in Geneva, exploring human rights trends. We are given freedom on what to choose to speak about and on what to say. And our reports, I would hope, act as a early warning system, telling the world, the diplomatic community, civil society, states, foreign ministries, and so on, about what is going on in our various specific mandates. So my reports have been on issues involving the issue of accountability, issues of annexation of territory, which are illegal under international law, issues of collective punishment, questions of economic development or lack of economic development, and so on. These reports are obviously publicly available, and I regularly deal with civil society and with journalists like yourself, speaking about issues on human rights trends in the occupied Palestinian territory.
So how would you say that your work relates to, or maybe in some cases even contrasts to, previous special rapporteurs on the occupied territories? Namely, I'm thinking about John Dugard and Richard Falk, who I previously had on my show. So how would you say that, do you build off their work? Is there differences between, say, what you're doing and maybe what Richard Falk or what John Dugard did? Could we get into that a little bit?
Sure. Richard Falk and John Dugard are giants. I humbly stand on their shoulders. And I like to think, to the best of my abilities, that I'm able to build upon the insights and the groundbreaking reports they'd issued over the last 20 years. John Dugard was allowed during his time between 2001 and 2008 to visit the occupied Palestinian territories, to meet with Israeli officials, to meet with Palestinian officials, and to see for himself what is going on the ground. I believe the Richard Falk, when he was appointed in 2008, was able to arrange a trip and was arrested and put in detention and put on the next flight back when he arrived in Israel, despite the fact that I think he had permission to be able to enter. So from then on, anybody in this position of special rapporteur for the occupied Palestinian territories is not allowed to go in. I've read their reports very carefully. I'd like to think they've created solid bricks in a wall that I keep adding bricks to in terms of an analysis and insight and initiatives. As I said, I'm not allowed to go into the occupied Palestinian territory. That's the decision of the Israeli government. They do not cooperate with my mandate. So what I do is, if you like, plan B is I go once a year to Amman, Jordan, where UN officials from Jerusalem or Ramallah or Gaza come and meet me there, as well as human rights organizations from Palestinian and Israeli civil society. I have to say, this is one of the very best documented conflicts in the world. And I stand on the shoulders as well of what Palestinian and Israeli and international civil society organizations and human rights defenders are saying, in the same way that John Dugard did, in the same way that Richard Falk wound up doing. So I'd like to think my reports are deep in fact, rich in fact, and rich in legal analysis, and they are a help to foreign ministries, to the United Nations itself, to critical journalists, to civil society organizations, in helping to understand what's going on in the occupied Palestinian territory, and also with recommendations on what ought to be done to try to curb the human rights abuses there.
I want to delve into this term occupation, because I feel like what we're seeing, it's almost something new entirely. I recently had Phyllis Bennis on, and she was saying this is essentially a permanent occupation. And she mentioned that, I believe, John Dugard and Richard Falk both said that we may need a new term in international law to describe this kind of occupation, because it is permanent.
Very good point. I always appreciate the work of Phyllis Bennis. Occupation developed after we had known of the term before, and it had legal connotations to it, but where it really became a mature, modern branch of international law was in the late 1940s, in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, when the world passed and adopted the four Geneva Conventions in 1949. And the fourth of those conventions, the fourth Geneva Convention, specifically addressed the rights of a people under occupation. And the whole premise of modern occupation law, if you like, and the laws of war, was that occupation had to be temporary. An occupying power gained not a single iota of sovereignty claim over the territory they're occupying. So when you think of modern occupations in the aftermath of the Second World War, the Americans occupied Japan beginning in 1945, and they were gone by the earlier mid-1950s, roughly 8 to 9 years of occupation. When the Western Allies occupied Western Germany, again in 1945, they were out of there, at least formally, by the mid-1950s, and West Germany became an independent country. When the Americans invaded Iraq in 2003, you know, that occupation formally lasted for 8 or 9 years. It is very clear in international law that occupations are temporary. They give give no sovereign claim to the occupying power. And while the occupying power is ruling, that occupying power has to act in the best interests of the people under occupation, their so-called protected population, and they have to obey the directions of the international community. And all four of those specific branches governing occupation have been violated by Israel. First and foremost, it denies that the territories are occupied. It has never accepted the fact that the Fourth Geneva Convention applies to the Palestinian territory, even though the Security Council has said, I believe, on 22 occasions that the Fourth Geneva Convention applies in full to the Palestinian territory. Israel has not heeded that. So what Phyllis Bennis and others have said in recent years is that this occupation shows no sign of ending. Israel has meant for it to be permanent, to be definite, at least for most parts of the occupied territory. It is annexed. East Jerusalem, contrary to international law, is annexed the Golan Heights, contrary to international law. And it has placed 680,000 settlers in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. You don't do that if you're planning for that to be a short vacation. You put civilian settlements into occupied territory in order to be able to establish permanent claims of sovereignty. And it has worked for Israel. Whenever we've gone through modern peace initiatives, beginning in the early 1990s, the very detailed legal framework that the Security Council and the General Assembly and the Human Rights Council has created to govern this has been ignored primarily by the United States in any of the major peace initiatives under the Oslo process from the early 1990s. This has allowed Israel to negotiate not within the framework of international law, which would say annexation is illegal, the settlements are illegal, the Palestinians have the right to self-determination. Instead, Israel is able to negotiate from the strength of its many illegal activities and facts on the ground, that it claims Jerusalem as its own. It claims sovereignty over all of the settlements that it's wind up creating. This is why almost all, well, all of the peace initiatives from the 1993 Declaration of Principles right up to the 2020 Trump plan have wound up failing because international law has been sidelined in these cases. So what civil society is now beginning to say is that that the laws of occupation are no longer expansive enough or equipped to be able to describe what is going on now. This is an annexation that has become indistinguishable. This is an occupation that's become indistinguishable from annexation. And a number of Palestinian, Israeli, and international human rights organizations, such as Al-Haq, Yashdin, Beth Salem, and now Human Rights Watch, are saying this amounts to apartheid. Even the European Union uses the term a one-state reality of unequal rights, which I think if you put that into Google Translate, that will come out as apartheid. So what human rights defenders are telling us is we need entirely new language, an entirely new political and legal framework for understanding what Israel is doing in the occupied territories.
I want to discuss the recent reports, and you mentioned Beth Salem and also Human Rights Watch. But first, in case I have listeners that are younger, just going off to college, you know, sometimes I think people can get mystified even by seemingly simple terms. What do we mean by annexation?
Sure. Annexation is the acquiring of territory which hadn't belonged to that country before and now being incorporated within the new boundaries set out by the occupying country or the conquering country. And obviously annexation reached its zenith during the Second World War with Nazi Germany, with Japan, and with Italy conquering other countries' territories, claiming them as their own, saying we needed Lebensraum, living room, to be able to put our own populations into, based on some kind of concept of superiority. The foundations of the United Nations, when it was created in 1945, was to end and make illegal the concept of annexation, that countries could no longer try to expand their borders beyond what has been recognized by the international community. And that, by and large, has been honored by most countries all of the time in the 76 years since the end of the Second World War. Right in Article 2 of the Charter of the United Nations, it establishes that annexation. It's been interpreted as saying annexation is profoundly illegal. That's not stopped some countries from trying to annex other territory that they've occupied. We can see other situations with respect to Turkey and northern Cyprus, Morocco and western Sahara, and certainly Israel and Palestine as being exceptions to the rule. But they are much, much rarer now that there's been a formal prohibition in international law since 1945 against annexation. And if I can add one thing to it, sometimes we lawyers talk about the concept of de jure annexation, formal annexation, which is what Israel has done with respect to East Jerusalem in 1980 and with the Syrian Golan Heights in 1981. But there's also the parallel concept of de facto annexation, where a country is putting facts on the ground in order to be able to make a future formal claim for annexation. And I think it's now becoming recognized that de facto annexation, let's say what Israel is doing in the West Bank, is just as illegal, just as prohibited under international law as de jure or formalized annexation. To its credit, several weeks ago, there was a motion passed unanimously in the Irish Parliament that said that de facto annexation is as illegal under international law as de jure annexation. It's one of the first countries that I'm aware of that has actually said this. And I'm hoping that's going to set the stage for other countries, hopefully in Europe and elsewhere, who will make the same claim and who will wind up therefore taking more definitive stance to hold Israel accountable for its many violations of international law.
So, since we mentioned the Human Rights Watch report and B'Tselem, recently, I think more people have been paying attention to these human rights violations that have been occurring in the occupied territories. But there's also been this sort of pushback. Recently, Bernie Sanders said, oh, maybe we shouldn't use the A word, apartheid, because there's been these issues with increased anti-Semitism. How would you respond to those concerns about increased anti-Semitism? And, you know, if we use the word apartheid, that may be playing into this anti-Semitism.
Oh, it's a nuanced and sometimes very complicated debate and discussion. I'm glad you've raised that. And, you know, anybody, I think, who analyzes what is going on in Israel and the occupied territories, you know, should be careful in their choice of language for a number of reasons. You know, one is anti-Semitism is a vile form of racism and discrimination in the same way that Islamophobia is as well. Secondly, I think in the end of the day, we know that the 6.8 million Israeli Jews and the 6.8 million Palestinian Arabs living between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River are not going anywhere. And they have to find out ways of living together with one another on the basis of equality and reconciliation, which they have a shared future together. And that shared future can either be one of domination, or can be one based on equality and justice. And therefore, we have to learn how to speak in terms that appeal to the universal values that Israeli Jews would wind up holding, and Jews in the diaspora would wind up holding as well. So those are all important things to keep in mind as we try to hold what I think would be and initiate an honest, open debate based on universal values, based on international law, with respect to the rights of Israelis and the rights of Palestinians. Now, turning to the word apartheid, yes, apartheid is a harsh word, and some people recoil from it. But in this case, it's describing a harsh situation. And I don't know any other word that we have in the English language that would aptly describe a situation where in the same geographic space, ruled by the same government, Israel, you have two different communities living side by side each other, Israeli Jews in the settlements and Palestinian Arabs living in their own communities in East Jerusalem and the West Bank and Gaza, where one group based on ethnicity and nationality enjoys a full range of what we would understand to be democratic and legal rights, the right to vote, the right to hold property, the right to be able to have guarantees with respect to social and economic conditions, the right to have fair trials in a legitimate justice system, where the other group living in the same territory are denied virtually all of those rights. You know, I have read the Human Rights Watch report. I've read what B'Tselem and Yashtin and Al-Haq have said, and I find them all to be very careful, very measured analysis of the current situation. And I'm persuaded by their analysis that this is indeed a form of apartheid, which is both illegal under international law and amounts to a violation of the Rome Statute under the International Criminal Court. So, I'd be interested in seeing detailed arguments coming from those who don't accept it. I've not seen those yet, but they would have to address that base question. How else do you describe this increasingly permanent situation of two peoples living side by side each other in the same geographic and political unit, yet enjoying a vastly different access to rights?
In regards to trying to address these issues, I think a lot of people recoil or feel intimidated by maybe
not being knowledgeable about all the history. And I often hear people say, oh, this is a religious thing. It goes back centuries. Or people will say, oh, both sides are bad. And, you know, I think there's a lot of reductionism that goes on. Or people get into debates about Zionism versus anti-Zionism. Let's just talk about the human rights angle to this. What are the main points that people should know if they're just beginning to learn about this issue?
Sure. That there's a lot to learn, but it's not as complex as some people make it out to be. Often I hear the argument, well, it's very complicated when someone is asked to describe the situation, particularly if they're defending the occupation. And I don't think is as nearly as complicated as that. At the end of the day, it's not fundamentally a battle over religious beliefs. It's not fundamentally a battle over ethnicity or nationality. It's a battle over rights and the lack of them. And I think that's the entry point to understanding what is going on. So the main human rights trends that you've asked me about, you know, have to do with access to political rights, access to legal rights and a fair judicial system, have to do with the right to self-determination. Because the right to self-determination, which the Palestinians have been promised, and yet the Palestinians have not had that right fulfilled, that in many ways is the precondition to all other rights. In my ability to be able to enjoy, as a Canadian, political rights and social rights is preconditioned on having a country that is able to deliver those sorts of rights. You know, as a Canadian, right to self-determination. And Palestinians don't have that right. It's been denied them. And therefore, because of domination over them, which is taking away their land and therefore taking away their livelihood and therefore taking away their intrinsic human rights, they lack what many of us in the world wind up enjoying. In Gaza, where 2 million Palestinians live, has been behind a comprehensive air, sea, and land blockade by Israel for 14 years. Virtually nothing and nobody is able to enter or leave Gaza without the permission of Israel. Prior Secretary Generals of the United Nations have described the situation, as I have described the situation regarding Gaza, as a form of collective punishment, which is illegal under the Fourth Geneva Convention. In East Jerusalem, which has been occupied by Israel since 1967 and was annexed by Israel in two stages in 1967 and 1980 illegally, Israel is moved in more than 225,000 Israeli Jews to live in Palestinian East Jerusalem alongside of around 330 to 350,000 Palestinians. And again, rights are differently assigned. If you're a Israeli Jew living in East Jerusalem, you have full political, legal, and social rights. If you're a Palestinian living in East Jerusalem, you have residency, but you don't have citizenship. You have some access to Israeli social benefits, but you don't have control over your city, over planning. The city council of Jerusalem is almost entirely made up of Israeli Jews, and there's virtually no Palestinian representation on the municipal council. And this means that zoning laws are discriminatory against Palestinians, property rights are insecure, and poverty rates and unemployment rates are much higher among Palestinians in East Jerusalem than they are among Israeli Jews either in West Jerusalem or in East Jerusalem. And with respect to the West Bank, which is where 2.7, 2.8 million Palestinians live alongside of about 450,000 Israeli settlers, they live on 165 separate islands, little disconnected territory, fragmented territory, and are completely surrounded by Israeli military. You can't go from one island, Palestinian island, to another. You can't go from Nablus in the north to Ramallah to Bethlehem to Hebron to Jericho without passing through and having permission, having been given to Israeli soldiers to decide to let you through or not let you through. And this is no way to be able to build a functioning economy or a functioning society if you live in these disconnected territories, little islands of land that a foreign occupying belligerent power winds up controlling. It means that you don't have control over water resources. The West Bank sits under an enormous mountain aquifer, which provides an immense amount of water. I didn't realize this before I became Special Rapporteur, because we often think of the Middle East and particularly Israel and Palestine as being very dry. But there's more rain that falls in Ramallah, the de facto capital of the Palestinians, than falls in London, England. Yet Palestinians don't control that water. It's controlled by Israel, and most of that water goes via the Israeli water company to either the Israeli settlements or to Israeli cities themselves. And it forces Palestinians to buy back their own water for their own use. So what occupation means, particularly this permanent occupation, means a lack of control over almost all the basic aspects of you as a people and you as an individual.
Also, since you mentioned former officials talking about this issue, specifically, didn't Kofi Annan, who was the former UN Secretary General, he covered this, right?
Yes. Kofi Annan wrote a very revealing memoir with a chapter on the Middle East called Interventions. It was published in 2011, I believe. And he said himself that this is a cruel, often brutal occupation, and that he was very critical of the Security Council for having passed more than 30 resolutions since 1967 with respect to the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territory, but never taking any meaningful action to hold Israel to account for its violations of international law and its defiance of all of these United Nations resolutions. And he went on to point a finger. He said, you know, one of the reasons why the Security Council is wrapped up in paralysis when it comes to Israel is the United States. That the United States has taken over ownership of the peace process that's gone on for the last 30 years with no meaningful results, and that the United States has wound up being a protector or defender of Israel at the Security Council, at the United Nations generally, and in international diplomacy, which is why you have this enormous gap, as was recognized by Kofi Annan, between the promise of international law, which has been often repeated by the General Assembly and the Security Council, and the actual performance, which is the utter lack of any forms of accountability imposed by the United Nations and the international community on Israel.
That actually brings me to a point that could sort of maybe bring us to a wrap-up moment in this conversation. I don't hear a lot of people talk about these issues in terms of international law. And it seems unfortunate that sometimes people will get bogged down in, like I said, debates about Zionism or anti-Zionism. Why do you think that is? Do you think that there's been a loss of faith in international law, or just a lack of education about the need to take a maybe human rights-centric approach to the Israel-Palestine issue?
Excellent point. You know, I've argued in several of my reports to the United Nations that we need, the international community needs to adopt a rights-based approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to the ending of the Israeli occupation. And that's been conspicuously absent over the last 30 years. As I had mentioned a few minutes ago, every single peace initiative under the umbrella of the Oslo framework since the early 1990s has identified what are the final status issues: Jerusalem, annexation, refugees, settlements, borders, Palestinian self-government, and so on. But they've never been placed within the very rich, very detailed framework of international law and human rights that the Security Council and the General Assembly has repeated over and over and over again. And that's been the primary reason, in my view, why all of these various peace initiatives over the past 30 years have wound up collapsing, is that it wasn't done within the sturdy legal framework of international law and rights. It was done under the very rickety framework of realpolitik, which means that the stronger party can wind up dominating over the much weaker party. When you look at the two parties together, I mean, Israel enjoys a vastly asymmetrical degree of power. Territorially, it really rules over all of Mandate Palestine, including the areas where there is municipal-like government for the Palestinians. Economically, Israel has a GDP per capita of around $43,000 or $44,000 per individual, where the Palestinians' economy is about 1/12 or 1/13 of that, at around $3,500 per capita American. Militarily, Israel has by far the strongest military in the region and one of the best equipped militaries in the entire world, where the Palestinians either have a police-like security role in the West Bank or low-grade rockets coming out of Gaza. The only area where there's parity in all of this is in population. The population is now roughly 50-50. The same number of Palestinian Arabs living in the same territory as the same number of Israeli Jews. And that number of Palestinians is only going to continue to increase. So, before very long, we'll be looking at a Jewish minority, an Israeli Jewish minority, ruling over a Palestinian majority without any of the or access to the same degree of rights that Israeli Jews wind up having.
So I just had two brief questions. The one I have to mention, because I know someone's going to get mad if I don't ask it. There's always this response when you get into this issue of human rights violations by Israel. People say, well, what about Hamas? So how do you respond to that?
Look, I support the ongoing investigations at the International Criminal Court with respect to breaches of the Rome Statute, commissions of war crimes, both by the which have been alleged against Israel from 2014 onward, but also by against Hamas and by other Palestinian armed groups as well. You may have a righteous cause. You may be on the side of law, and you may be on the side of history in the cause that you fight for. But you still have to, that doesn't mean that the laws of war don't apply to you if you're on a righteous side. They apply to you as well. And the use by Hamas of firing rockets, destructive rockets, into Israeli civilian settlements or into towns and cities is a war crime under the recognized laws of war, in the same way that is alleged that Israel has fired disproportionately missiles and artillery into built-up areas in Gaza and caused significant civilian deaths. Both of those, I think, are grounds that are ripe for review by the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, and I hope that those investigations wind up proceeding. My own views with respect to Hamas's politics is beside the point, but what they have done with respect to defending Palestinians, you know, when you shoot rockets into civilian territories and kill Israeli civilians, is an own goal, as they would wind up saying in soccer. That ultimately doesn't help your cause with respect to that. There are more creative and more law-abiding methods of wind up defending your people and advocating their achievement of rights than by firing those rockets.
So the last point I wanted to make here, since we were talking about international law and taking a human rights-centric approach, recently I was very impressed by a paper that came out from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace entitled Breaking the Israel-Palestine Status Quo. It was authored by Zaha Hassan, Daniel Levy, and a few others. And it's arguing that, you know, instead of necessarily focusing on philosophical debates about a one-state or a two-state solution, that right now what is most important is taking a human rights centric approach. I found it very telling that this report came out, and I think that maybe it's a sign that we're moving in the right direction. Do you think that we are moving towards maybe accepting a more human rights centric approach to Israel and Palestine?
Well, to paraphrase John Lennon, you know, give rights a chance. If all of the prior peace initiatives have failed because they did not put rights and international law at the center of their framework, then why not take the initiative that the Carnegie Endowment Report is advocating? I've read the report, I agree with the report, and I hope the report gets widely read, not only in Washington, but obviously at university campuses, but also in capitals elsewhere in the world. In its own very cautious language, the Carnegie Endowment Report points out the centrality of international law. It points out where it's worked in other circumstances at being able to build the kind of compromises needed to curb a, you know, a awful use of political and military might to put the parties on a more equal playing field. The very advantage of using a rights-based approach is that it lessens the disparities or the asymmetrical power between two quite on equal powers, and it gets them to negotiate on established rights. And there is, as I've said before, no conflict in the modern world where the international community has pronounced with such frequency and with such rich detail in law than on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We've got this framework been waiting for us to be able to use, waiting there for the last 54 years. And it is entrenched, you know, in Security Council resolutions, Human Rights Council resolutions, General Assembly resolutions. Let's put it together. I've advocated this. The Carnegie Endowment Report certainly advocates this. My predecessors as special rapporteurs certainly pushed this as well. Give rights a chance. Give this basis. Who could argue? Who in the end could actually argue or put forth a persuasive, convincing argument that we should discard rights, that we should discard international law? These represent the universal values that we've all countries have won a buy-in into. Whether they actually adhere to it, is a different question. But they've all formally, rhetorically accepted it. And certainly, as Kofi Annan said in his memoirs, you've got this existing framework. All you need to do is incorporate it into the next peace initiative and ensure that it's respected by all parties to it. And you will wind up having the best chance you've ever had of getting an end to the occupation, and whether it be a one-state solution or a two-state solution, you would get some kind of a political framework between Palestinians and Israeli Jews that is going to be able to stand the test of time. It's going to build those principles and those pillars of justice and democracy and security that any functioning society needs to rely upon.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. I want to thank you, Michael Link, for coming on Parallax Views. If you have any closing comments, or if you want to let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work, please feel free to do so now.
Sure. You know, there is a UN website at the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights that contains all of my reports, all of my statements with respect to the work I do as Special Rapporteur, and I would certainly welcome people to visit it and to be able to read it. And I'm a lawyer, and I do write on legal issues with respect to Israel and Palestine. But I hope that the language I've chosen and the framework I've adopted is accessible to anybody who cares about human rights and is curious about learning more about this particular conflict and on how to end this occupation.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Michael Link, the current United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian-occupied territories since 1967. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to K.
Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.